I'd like to ask you about what was available to the pilot. If you were hooked up onto the cable, you drop the messenger cable, you're on the haul down cable, and for whatever reason, and it's a hypothetical question at this point in time, you have to disengage. The pilot can do that from the cockpit and disengage from the haul down system?
Yes, you had two methods of doing it. You could just disengage the messenger and it would drop down. You make sure that no one underneath, because it's quite a piece of iron. And the other way was you'd cut the cable in a real emergency. When you had to, you could cut the cable.
Now, cutting the cable, from some of the documents that I've come across, that was done with a small explosive charge.
That's
Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. And so the cutting of the cable would be down near the bear trap itself?
No. It would be right under, it would be right under, if I remember correctly, it was...
The probe housing?
It was within the probe housing.
All right.
You know, just under the messenger.
Now that would be for worst case scenario.
That's right. You know, because you always could release manually.
Right. Did you, during any of the trials, have an occasion to release manually for whatever reason that you can remember?
Well, I think there was one at night incident where things were getting a little bit out of hand, you know, and I thought very seriously about letting go, but didn't. We sorted it out. But it's a question of perceptions and vertigo and... when you feel things are getting not safe, it's a judgment call, is what all you can say.
Right. Under what sort of circumstances would a pilot start to experience vertigo?
Oh, you can experience it under any circumstances, you know, really. But basically what happens is you lose peripheral vision, you lose references, you know, and then you're... getting a little bit mixed up as to whether the ship's moving or you're moving or
right.
whatever, and you know, then things begin to lie to you,
and it becomes very dangerous.
Well, it can be, you know. But if you've experienced vertigo, you'll know that you're getting it, and there are things you can do to try and minimize the effects.
All right. When you say that you had entertained the idea of releasing manually during one night landing, was that because of the particular conditions at the time, the sea conditions or wind?
Well, it was a combination, sea, visibility. Things were not very nice out there, and it just started getting what I thought was a little bit dicey. Because I was beginning to, as I said, starting to follow the ship instead of staying where I should have been.
Was the horizon bar in place during that particular flying operation? Or did that come later?
No, I think that came later. Yeah.
Was this also following the trials with the heads-up display in the Sea King?
Boy, you've got me on that... just when it came, I don't know. I think I had the heads-up display, but it was, for a heads-up display, you can put it in quotes, I mean, it was pretty damn basic.
Was it?
Oh, it was just a piece of plate of glass with a horizon.
All right.
You know, a bar, and that was it.
Oh, really? Okay.
You know, there was no other information on it. So.
One of the pieces of information that I was able to find out about as it related to the heads-up display trials, from the pilot's perspective, they didn't like it because it was one more thing to focus on and took their concentration or their field of vision away from other things that they should be focusing on.
Well, that's because the unit itself was so basic and so so new, because the idea of a heads-up display is that you're focused at whatever you're focused on outside. You know, but at the same time, that you can see what's on your heads-up display.
Right. Okay.
So you're not really focused on the heads-up display. You're focused on whatever is going on in the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
But having the focal length of the heads-up display at infinity lets you see what's going on with your instruments or
right, okay,
or whatever other information is on there.
So because of the lack of paperwork here, because the heads-up display was rejected at this point in time anyhow during the trials for the Sea King helicopter, is that when they made the decision that they would install the horizon bar aboard
well,
the ship?
You needed something, you know, and especially at night and then poor visibility conditions and the ship is jumping around underneath you, you needed something to indicate outside the cockpit where the horizon was. Because a pilot could not really afford to be looking at instruments and up, you know, instruments and then out, instruments and out.
A lot can happen between.
That's right. You know, so you have to have something to give you some sort of a horizon reference. Now, you didn't, that did not take care of the ship moving up and down,
mm-hmm.
you know, which was a complicating factor, but at least you had something that says, okay, you know, I'm level.
What other visual references were provided for the pilots, you, during the trials for the night flying?
We played around with some lights, obviously, and there was floodlights on the deck.
Was the flight deck lighted at all?
Yes, we edge lit it, and we also flood lit it.
All right.
You know, trying to see what that would do for you, you know, but as to exact details now, boy, that's...
Now, what was that like from the pilot's perspective during night trials to be flying in pitch black conditions to come into a relatively brightly lit area and then perhaps be waved off and then go back into pitch dark again and then come around?
Not very comfortable, obviously. But no, but the lighting was not that bright, and it was variable. You could play with it, you know, to where everybody felt comfortable.
All right.
So, but you needed some sort of lighting reference just to find the ship.
Now, this lighting was all in addition to the lighting that was the green and red lights from the LSO. Was that system also in place during the trials?
Yes.
Yeah. And that was just for the hookup and for the haul down. And
yeah.
I understand that there was a similar sort of lighting system that was put in the bridge so that the CO knew exactly when the helicopter was secured into the bear trap.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. No, that was just, you know, trials. Again, you're trying things out and saying, okay, what works, what doesn't work.
Now, were you writing reports on a daily basis?
Yes, we were, and this is one of the bane of test flying, of course, is that 1 hour's flight requires about 8 hours writing, which is about normal ratio.
Is it?
So, yeah.
All right. Now, all of these reports that you were writing, they were going back to VX-10 as primarily, I assume?
Yes. Well, it was all going into the book, so to speak, you know, because finally you had to put out a final report.
All right. As so, part of the project directorate
right.
for VX-10.
The final report saying, okay, this thing works or it doesn't work or, you know.
And this was, I think, 102 if I remember correctly, but that was broken down into a number of different components.
That's right.
All right. So you were writing more reports than you were probably actually flying during these trials. Would that be accurate?
Yes.
All right.
Well, not only myself, but my co-pilot, you know, and everybody involved had to write a report on the day's activities.
The LSOs and the yes. CO and the XO and
well,
maintenance no, people
not,
and
not so much the ships because they were a little bit, you know, like a castle unto themselves, you know. But,
right.
Their involvement was distant, you know, about 50 feet distant, 4 foot. But no, if there is something to be contributed, then yes, you get it. You know, it was your responsibility as a project officer to talk to the ship's company and find out problems from their perspective, you know, and what solutions we can come up with. You know, one obvious one that came to mind immediately was firefighting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Assiniboine, when it came out, was from the perspective of the aircrew, was inadequately equipped for firefighting. you know, this million pieces of machinery flying information, if it decides to thrash itself to death on the flight deck, boy, you've got a problem. You know, and that was borne
mm-hmm.
out
mm-hmm.
by just a fuel spill and subsequent fire in one of the other destroyers.
Oh, really?
You know, that they had a very serious yeah. fire. Not only, if I remember correctly, there was there were even some people who were killed.
And so this would have been following the Assiniboine trials for the fire?
Well, it was unrelated.
All right.
It was, you know, it was something happened in the DDH.
Mm-hmm.
Know, fire started down below, and bang, you know, all of a sudden, the whole place fills up with smoke and everything.
Oh, boy. Where was the JP5 stored? Was that in a tank below the hangar?
Yes.
And it was fed up to yeah. the through the hoses to the hangar itself?
Yeah.
And
that flight deck.
To the flight deck. And so all fueling took place out on the flight deck.
That's right.
All right. Now, Stretch Arnold was talking about how the Canadian Navy actually started doing hot fueling. Was any of that going on during the trials, or was the
no.
engine always shut down and you were...
No, basically in those very early days, at least I didn't, when I was doing my portion of the trials, we never did hot refueling. I think that came later on.
All right.
No, and there's, intrinsically, there's nothing wrong with hot refueling. You know, it's done all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as you get the right systems.
Right.
The thing that you have to watch for is spills. You know, and what do you do if the system that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, when you finish fueling and you pull the hose off the airplane and it doesn't stop, you know, it keeps on gushing. You know, what do you do now?
Right. You potentially know, so very dangerous situation.
You bet.
Very dangerous yeah. situation. Do you remember any problems, mechanical problems with the aircraft during the trials that you were involved with? I'm speaking because during the early trials on Buckingham, for example, and then Ottawa, during the local exercises and trials, the helicopter was frequently disembarked and returned to Shearwater and then joined the ship the next day if there was a trial to be carried out.
Mm.
Was that the case on Assiniboine? Did it, for the local trials?
Yeah, if we had major major problems, of course you flew it back to Shearwater where they had everything to fix it. You know, when we deployed, for instance, up to Newfoundland, well, then we had our own maintenance crew with a modicum of spares on board.
Now, that would have been, you would have had the full, they called it a helideck at the time?
No, it wasn't full helideck. It was test helideck.
All right, so it was skeleton crew.
Skeleton, yeah.
And I guess they couldn't carry out very much in the way of maintenance or repairs.
Could do level one maintenance, you know. It's amazing what people can do if they're forced to, you know, and if you bend a few rules and regulations, you know, and all of a sudden, all kinds of things are possible.
Right.
But basically the idea was that any major maintenance would be done ashore, at least during the trials period.
All right, and whatever
you know,
minor...
And major maintenance could be trialed later when it was decided just to what to... spares suit was going to be, what the number of maintainers and types of maintainers, etc., etc., when the full crew was thought out and said, okay, this is what we need.
Right, okay.
You know, so, but during the time that I was doing the flying, nothing really major that I can think of. We had some problems with the probe system, but and the tailwheel business, of course, where we, you know, ended up solving that by hooking on another set of pulleys.
Right.
Which is not desirable.
No?
No.
Why is that?
Because it's just another piece of machinery to go wrong.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You know.
All right.
Now you've got to, you know, all of a sudden if you pull it the wrong way, you know. You're
creating all sorts of problems, like additional stress on the fuselage,
right.
and that sort of thing.
You know, so, you know, and there were problems with the bear trap, of course, lots of them.
Now, can you speak about some of those problems as it relates to the trials and the flying?
Well, for instance, when I think it was the Minister of National Defense at the time came to visit, and we had to put on a trial for him, you know, I stationed two sailors in the howdah, which is the machinery room, you know, gave him a set of good work gloves each and said, whatever you do, don't let this cable go loose, you know. So I got hauled down by two sailors quite often, demonstrating this. You know, so, no, but the thing was not very reliable, and again, I guess the engineering was so different, mm-hmm. you know, what you were trying to accomplish, and you were trying to accomplish constant tension units, and Ferry really had not too much experience with that, and, you know, and then the size of the thing, and how it worked, you know, and the guts of the sheaves. So there were constant problems. You know, they were all soluble, and they were all solved, and obviously they are solved.
Right.
You know, with some modifications, because the thing works quite well right now.
And
but in the early days, you know, quite often I'd have to come in and need a free deck or especially if we're demonstrating anything. Well, we always had the cable hooked up, and I said I'd have two sailors down there hauling me down.
Do you have any recollections of doing free deck landings when you were supposed to be testing the haul down system in the bear trap? Where it was
not really. You know, you did free deck when you had to. You know, in other words, when the bear trap quit.
Right.
You know, but that's when you did free deck, or you were alongside doing a demonstration for Her Majesty's representative or whoever VIP happened to be around at the time. But, you know, the two things you have to remember is the free deck part of it. You know, if you did a truly free deck, then you had to tie the thing down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then of course, your bear trap itself was of no use to you.
Right.
However, if they... For instance, quite often happened, the tensioning device, the haul down part of it didn't work, but the traversing part worked. Well, then you'd land, and with a little bit of finesse, you put the probe into the trap, and at least you could haul the thing into the hangar.
Right, properly. you were secured to the deck, and you could be traversing into the hangar. But if you're doing any free deck landings and you're not tied up alongside, or you're not in Bedford Basin, and there's a problem with either the haul down, for example...
Well, you have a problem, yes.
You're doing a free deck landing, yeah, where the conditions might not be quite right for a free deck landing.
Well, you know, if that, then there's always, if you're close enough to shore, you go ashore. But if you're out in the middle of the ocean, you know, somewhere between Bermuda and Halifax, well...
There's no shore base.
That's right. You do what you have to.
And do you remember having to do free deck landings with the haul down or the bear trap not working, but being too far away to land at the shore base?
Not really, no. No, we did them just to try it out and see what the problems are going to be. And as you gather experience, you know, any one of these guys, like Spitnew and Stretch, Jerry Moore, you know, they could put that probe into a six-inch circle.
Really? You know? That's pretty precision flying, I would say.
Well, no, in other words, you know, you figured out just where you had to be,
mm-hmm.
what your visual cues were when you landed. You knew your probe was in the bear trap. And then, of course, it was up to the LSO to catch you as soon as you touched down.
Right, okay. Do you have any recollections of having to land aboard an alternative flight deck, another destroyer, or more particularly the carrier, for example?
No, not in those early days.
All right.
Not in those early days. No, we basically, you know, the furthest we got away to was Newfoundland when we were looking for rough weather.
And this was during the Assiniboine trials or the Annapolis trials?
Assiniboine.
Now, Assiniboine wasn't very successful in finding the rough weather that she was looking for, and that was carried over to the Annapolis trials.
Well, we found some rough weather, but you never found exactly what you were looking for. So, you know, but it got to be rough enough. I've got pictures of Assiniboine rolling, you know, 30 degrees plus. So.
Oh, really? Oh, I'd love to see those photos. Okay. Now, that's definitely pushing the envelope for landing.
Well,
is it not?
Oh, yeah. No, but I mean, you don't land in those conditions. You wait till the ship stabilizes and then you
land. And then land, all right.
You know, your problem there is hovering, mm-hmm. you know, or trying to keep yourself still in space or fixed in space relative to the ship. Let the ship do whatever it wants.
Right. Now, this isn't something that was being investigated during the trials, and I ask this for another reason. Coming in on the circuit and for the approach and the landing and the haul down, it varied depending upon conditions, and I'm not sure that you can use this word, but I'll try. What would be the average from sort of the approach to the hover to the messenger cable being dropped, the haul down cable being hauled up, hauled down to the flight deck, secured, and traversed into the hangar? If
5 minutes.
5 minutes?
Yeah.
All right. And
yeah, you could, but, you know, these guys, we've been practicing it a lot now, probably do it a whole lot quicker than that.
Right. And
we were just being...
Yeah, you're testing the system,
that's
and
right.
That's not your concern.
We were very careful. Of course it was our concern, but we were very careful. You know, and if you needed more time, you just took more time.
Right, okay.
There was no operational requirement, you know, to be quick.
Right, okay. What about the reverse now for takeoff? I mean, the aircraft has been fueled. You've done your checklist. Matter of a minute or 2 minutes, perhaps?
Just long enough to run up the engine.
All right. And
for the ship to stabilize and off you go.
Did you have to have wind over the deck for takeoff? No?
No, his too was very good that way. You know, you had performance. You had performance to spare. Really.
I remember reading one of the criticisms of the early helicopters, particularly down off the coast of Florida in conditions of high humidity, that they didn't hover very well.
Temperature and humidity.
Temperature and humidity. How did the Sea King respond to similar conditions?
Well, you know, you solved most of these problems by the gas turbine.
All right.
You know most of the early helicopters, gas turbine helicopters, the problem wasn't power so much, it was absorption of power. You know, in other words, the gas turbine could produce more power than the gearing or the hardware could take.
So that's when you talk about the reduction gears to the rotor
gear,
gearbox.
Because
the first gas turbines for the Sea Kings, they were producing about 3,000 or 4,000 horsepower each. Is that right?
No, they're about 1,200.
1,200. All right,
yeah.
But that's still well above what the rotor shaft could handle in terms of.
Well, with two of them, yeah.
Right. Okay.
You know, there was room to spare. In other words, you know, since then the helicopter has undergone many, many modifications, gearboxes included. Of course, the engines have
improved quite a bit too. All right.
But that was the thing that you had to remember with those early turbine helicopters. Is usually power, especially at sea level, was not the problem.
All right. It was,
you know, for the S-55 or the...
which was the piston engine.
That's right. Yeah.
And they were about, I think, 800 horsepower or something like
that. Well, that was the H-04Ss, yeah. The 55 that we borrowed for the Air Force for the bigger trials, that had R-1820 in it. So that was about 1,300 horsepower.
Right, quite a bit, quite an improvement over
H-04Ss.
The earlier
yeah.
variant, all right.
Which was quite an improvement over the Bell.
I'm sure. What I'm not sure about this either, and this is kind of an unrelated question. What was sort of the operational ceiling of the Sea King helicopter? I've seen a figure of about 11,000 or 12,000 feet.
That sounds about right.
Is that about right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I've had it up that high. It depended also, you see, what you get into is a neat little problem of, you know, where you're sort of running up an apex. Fixed wing do the same thing, mm-hmm. you know. If you go too far this way, you're into shock waves and all the problems associated with that. If you go too far this way, you're into stall.
Right.
You know, and it all comes to a point.
Okay, and where they meet.
You don't want to be.
That's pushing the envelope too far. What about the sort of normal cruising speed of the Sea King? Would that be about 120, 115 knots, somewhere in there?
Yeah, well, it was in my day. You know, I don't know what they do now, because they've improved systems considerably. But basically, it was about 115, 120 knots.
All right.
You know, and you bounced around quite nicely. You know, there's quite a vibratory environment if you were doing it that.
Doing that speed?
Yeah.
All right. And correct me if I'm wrong, the normal cruising was about 4.5 hours?
Yeah, you can, you know, I'd have to look up the specs.
All right.
The technical orders for the airplane, because I don't remember exactly what it was. But you had a good bunch of fuel in there. Now, you could get rid of it very quickly in the hover.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and especially if you're heavy and doing some heavy hover work, sonar dipping and all the rest of that. But basically, it was a pretty good airplane from that point of view.
Do you remember or were you involved with the trials that related to the autopilot going from forward flight into the hover down onto, you know, 50 feet above the water, which was all punched in onto the automatic pilot?
Yeah, not really. I tried it a couple of times, obviously, you know, but it was a pretty exciting ride. But no, I didn't do any of the real test work on that.
Now, that's from what I understand, a very tricky and potentially dangerous operation.
Well, if you should, you know, if the one of the engines coughs, you're going swimming.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's, you know, any of those are potentially dangerous. You know, but yes, it's tricky because you're trying to do quite a few things at the same time, and then once you get there, you know, you're trying to again stay still in space, you know, to get your sonar down to where it belongs.
Right.
But you know, to get there, you know, the helicopter has got to go through transition into a hover,
mm-hmm.
and there's all kinds of aerodynamic things happening then, you know. And then once you're there over the ocean, it's kind of hard to tell which way you're moving.
Right.
And you can be moving up to 30 knots without any indication in the cockpit, unless you've got Doppler radar or something like that.
So, and this becomes even more important during night flying?
Oh, yeah.
Because you've got absolutely no terms of reference?
You bet.
So you are in forward flight, hypothetically 300 or 400 feet off the water, going through the transition into the hover about 40, 50 feet over the water to drop the sonar ball.
That's right.
For the passive or the active pinging, and you're doing this at night, mm-hmm. and you can't distinguish between the sky and the sea because it's so dark. You've got no visual reference.
Well, you have no horizon reference, usually. You can usually tell the difference between the sky and the sea because you will see the reflection of your running lights in the water. But in wartime, of course, those would be off.
Right.
But, you know, basically you were instrument flying.
And so those trials would have been very difficult and a lot of work for the engineers that were involved. The VX-10 electrical engineers, I assume, are the ones that had the as well.
Well, we did quite a bit of it, but don't forget the United States Navy was doing, you know,
so
a major part of the work.
So they were sharing of information.
Well, they had to.
Right. Okay. Those particular trials or component of the trials came after the Assiniboine trials and the haul down, I assume, and
yes.
would have that would have been either Annapolis or Nipigon?
Oh, I have no, you know, once I was out of it, I'm afraid I was pretty well out of it.
Right.
You know, I left VX10, I went to England for a year on staff college course, and you know, you lose track very, very quickly of what's going on.
But you became OIC in August 1965, is that correct, for VX10?
I became senior test pilot, yeah.
In 65?
Yeah, I was 2IC of the squadron.
All right. So we'll just stop the tape here and turn it over.